So last night, I walked through the living room while my husband was watching the miniseries Band of Brothers. I actually haven't seen it yet, but I walked in on a scene where one of the members of the 506 is talking to a Brit in a tank and trying to reason with him about how to engage the enemies in town. The driver was being dense and arrogant, and they ended up losing the battle. It was a dreadful loss. But anyway, I'm not here to talk about the Market Garden disaster, but that driver. As I watched him, I said to my husband, he must be one of Monty's guys. I didn't only say it because he was driving a tank, but also because of how he was behaving. He reminded me of Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery, Monty for short. Mark frowned and said, yeah, it's ridiculous and they're going to lose the battle. It's the Bridge Too Far battle, referring to the movie A Bridge Too Far, which I am familiar with. And so that's what we're going to talk about today, namely what it means to be an image bearer, what it means for one person to faithfully represent another, for better or worse. My name is Tyler Don Rosenquist of the Ancient Bridge Ministries, and you can catch my websites, theancientbridge.com, contextforkids.com, and past broadcasts of this show can be accessed and downloaded through my Podbean channel, characterincontext.podbean.com. Now, image bearing is a subject we find all through Scripture, beginning with Genesis 1:26. And then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea, over the flying creatures of the sky, over the livestock, over the whole earth, and over every crawling creature that crawls on the land." God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the land, and conquer it. Rule over the fish of the sea, the flying creature of the sky, and over every animal that crawls on the land." You see a lot of confusion about this concept nowadays. But possibly the best way to describe this is by thinking of image bearers as ambassadors on steroids. No, I'm not talking about muscle-bound representatives, but instead representatives who are meant to be the perfect likenesses of the character and will of the person or God whom they are representing, or in our days, the government. For example, I studied Babylonian religion some years ago because something came up in Ezekiel 8. I didn't understand it. Just one thing led to another. Anyway, so Ishtar's priests were actually cross-dressers, and when I study this using actual books written by experts in the field, archaeologists, people who have translated and studied and pored over the cuneiform tablets where her myths are stored, the writings of like people like Berossus and Sanchuniathon, people who were alive in those days who knew firsthand what the worship of these different gods and goddesses was like. So anyway, Ishtar's priests were actually cross-dressers because she was a goddess known for role reversals, and her celebrations involved servants and masters reversing their roles for the day, with the master serving the servant. Oh man, you better hope you were nice to them the rest of the year, because you'd be dreading that day. And actually, the servant, if he didn't behave himself that day, would probably die the next day. This could get dangerous. But anyway, back to this. She was also the goddess of prostitution, and so her cult had no virgins in it. If one wanted to represent Ishtar, it was all about rulership. She was queen of heaven in Babylonian religion. Her sister was the queen of the underworld. I don't know which one I'd rather have to deal with. They were both pretty nasty. Anyway, it was all about rulership, war. She was the goddess of war, treachery, prostitution, and you would promote the emblems of 8-pointed stars, lions, and owls. You couldn't represent Ishtar as a mother goddess because she was not a mother goddess. She's actually one of the few goddesses you will see in antiquity who isn't associated with having kids. She is also not associated with marital faithfulness because she had a string of husbands with whom she had treacherously dealt, like especially Temuz, whom she consigned to hell 6 months a year for the audacity of not mourning her properly when her sister trapped her there. She came up to the surface to see her husband, and he wasn't exactly mourning. Oh, bad mojo. Anyway, and she'd also married a bunch of animals and thrown them aside. I know. As we know from a ton of archaeological evidence, both in her mythology recovered in the form of cuneiform tablets and her unearthed temple in Nineveh, which was full of documents, her cult was anything but serene. And her followers had to take part in some very bizarre rituals. That being said, no eggs, no bunnies, no Ishtar Sunday. We only see that sort of urban legend prop up about 200 years ago, and nothing in any sort of archaeology to back it up. But, you know, in the days before the modern archaeological push, a lot of people actually got to make stuff up, and especially like Grimm, you know. You get these legends that popped up that aren't based on archaeological evidence, but they're romantic literature, and people were very obsessed with ancient stuff, and they didn't. It's not like anybody had the ability to check up on this stuff. You had the name of something, and you went from there, sometimes based on carvings and reliefs, and sometimes just based on nothing at all. How about the priests of Oannes? What would you do if you were bearing their image? Now, according to Berosus, a 4th century Babylonian priest of Bel, and I think I got that right, I think he was 4th century BCE, the Babylonians believed that Oannes rose up from the ocean and taught men wisdom. He can be seen in cylinder seals and carvings as a strange being looking like a fish, standing up with a man's head under the fish head and a man's feet under the fish's tail and arms. Now, he's often misidentified as Dagon, thanks to David Kimhi in the 13th century and Dante's Inferno from the 14th century. You know, when something gets mentioned in Dante's Inferno, it's like practically, you know, practically scripture, because everyone's just going to say, oh, well, Dante must have known what he was talking about. But by that time, you know, the knowledge was a lot of it lost. But well over 1,000 years before that, Philo of Byblos, who lived in the 1st century, identified Dagon as a grain god, and which the Bible supports, by the way, because like when they got rid of the Ark of the Covenant out of the Temple of Dagon, first they took it to a field. Think, okay, you can deal with Dagon in the field. That's where he has his cosmic importance. Well, you know, you can battle him out there. So, anyway, Oannes, because he was identified as this man-fish sort of conglomeration, his priests wore the same outfit, bearing his image, and they can be seen in cylinder seals harvesting fruit from the tree of life. So you'll see them, they're fish things, and, you know, they're standing up like men, they got feet under their fins. It's really funny. Type in O-A-N-N-E-S into Google or whatever, and you'll come up with pictures of him. And the priests would have little baskets, and you would see them in front of a tree. It was always the tree of life, and it was growing fruit, and they would harvest the fruit of wisdom because Oannes brought wisdom to man. So because he was the bringer of wisdom, that had to be reflected by his priests. They couldn't be silly like Ishtar's priests. Of course, Ishtar's priests didn't think themselves silly. They thought that was very serious, and but erratic. She was an erratic goddess. She was not someone you wanted to mess with. Not even if you, especially not if you were her husband or her sister, who was just as bad. Now, this isn't a difficult concept. Mother goddesses like Asherah and Isis wouldn't behave like goddesses of war like Ishtar or Astarte of the Canaanites. Isis, of course, was Egyptian. Asherah was Canaanite. Can actually find pottery in ancient Israel that said Yahweh and his Asherah. It was written, you know, and they had a carving because they made, they worshipped her alongside God for at least some time. It's part of the syncretism of ancient Israel. Anyway, you can look that up online. So, anyway, the goddesses of war would not behave like the goddess of wisdom, Diana, who was an Ephesian goddess, who wouldn't behave like the goddess of love, Aphrodite, or any of the other goddesses of love. A grain god like Dagon would not behave like Ares, the god of war, who wouldn't behave like Tammuz, who was a shepherd god, not a sun god, shepherd god, who wouldn't behave like an underworld god, like Osiris, all right? Who wouldn't behave like Horus, who was more of a kingly god. Different cosmic functions meant entirely different personalities that would need to be faithfully represented by the priests, who would serve as mirrors of the gods to the people. Now, what does all this have to do with the Field Marshal Monty at the beginning of the broadcast? It means that I know enough about him that I could recognize one of his people, because he was acting just as insufferably as his commander. I could tell by the tactics, by the fact that he wouldn't listen to the people on the ground before him. He was being a good image bearer, unfortunately. Image bearers provide a mirror of the character of the one being represented. The guy in the tank didn't need to look exactly like Monty to bear his image on the battlefield. He just had to act like him and carry out his orders, for good or for bad. To treat people the way Monty would treat people. If he had gone against orders and had cooperated, the Allies might have won the Battle of Market Garden, which Monty portrayed as a win to the media, by the way. But he would have been a bad image bearer for his commanding officer. When man was created as image bearer in Genesis 1, so we're getting back to the Bible here, after that long, you know, but I just wanted to, I'm trying to make this clear. When man was created as an image bearer in Genesis 1, we see some interesting things associated with, as well as some that are notably absent. One, nowhere does it say that man will look exactly like us. Let's face it, we all look different. We have different genders. We have different colors. We have different this. We have different that. It's not about how you look. God wasn't making clones. He wasn't making other gods. He was making human beings after his likeness. The scriptures plainly say that we serve an invisible God, and that Yeshua is, or you might know him as Jesus, is the visible image of him. Does that mean they're twins? Not likely. We do see, number two, we do see one important attribute listed. Namely, and this is over and over again, ruling. Man was made to rule after God's likeness, according to his wisdom and expressed character, his benevolent, merciful, and creative authority. When God created the earth, and the creation epic in Genesis, although atheists will say, this is just like any other creation epic, you know, everyone does have one, but this one isn't like any of the others because of how God portrays himself versus the creation epics of every other god in the world. Now, when God created the earth, he showed his nature, which, unlike the pagan gods, was orderly, not chaotic, not the result of war or selfishness. It was very caring and well planned out. God created a universe when he needed nothing. He was complete, okay? God was complete. He made a world that didn't serve his own needs, but the needs of the creation that he would fill it with. An orderly place, suitable for life, as opposed to the chaos that heathen gods just barely, when they decided to, held back. He showed himself to be predictable and merciful, forgiving yet firm, and self-controlled instead of controlling. These are the opposites of the other gods in the universe who were worshipped by the nations who, when something went wrong, People didn't even know how they'd offended the gods, or even which god they had offended. It's John Walton who talks about the sacrificial... he just talks about these poor people. You get documents, and I couldn't find the letter, but someone prayed, wrote a prayer saying, I don't know what I did wrong and who I did it wrong to, but please forgive me. And he would go from temple to temple offering sacrifices because his life had gone so terrible, and he didn't know what he'd done because the other gods didn't have clear-cut things that they say, you do this and you don't do this. You just had to hope you were pleasing these guys. So, false gods were, for all intents and purposes, every bit as depraved as humans, but, again, as John Walton says in Ancient Near Eastern Thought in the Old Testament, which is the best beginner book that there is out there. We all cut our teeth on it, all my co-teachers and me. But without the limitations. So they're as depraved as humans, but they don't have the same limitations. I mean, think about it. How much horrible stuff do we do just because we don't have limitations? I used to when I lived in the Bay Area of California, and I'm not proud of this, but maybe you can relate. When I would be driving in traffic and somebody wouldn't use their turn signals, I would just point my finger at them and say, I wish that my finger had the power to make someone not be able to breed. Okay? And then what happens? I'm barren. We find that out years later. No, I don't think it's related because I've always been that way. You just don't find out until later. I got wrathful over turn signals. Sometimes I get wrathful over people taking up two parking spaces, people not returning their cars, people driving across parking lots without looking the way they're going and almost hitting the people who are actually, you know. Okay, now it's just I'm nursing my own agendas here, so. We all have our stuff, right? We all have our stuff. Some of you, it's like, oh, I just, those people who don't put the toilet paper on the roll, right? Right? What kind of horrible gods would we be if we could take out our whims on people? Oh, God is so good. And we are so not. So anyway, these gods, because they didn't have our limitations, they could act. They could, like, act fully on whatever they want to do. They could take out their worst qualities and their most ridiculous whims on poor, helpless mankind. And so their worshipers acted just like them. And everyone acts like the ones they truly worship, like Adam and Eve becoming deceptive right after they transferred loyalty from God to the serpent in the garden. And the children of Israel, they were called unruly, stiff-necked, and described as eager to throw off the yoke only after they worshiped the golden calf. So it's interesting, whenever you see mankind doing something, watch the language about them change. Because all of a sudden, I can't remember how many times and how many verses, the word stiff-necked gets mentioned by God when referring to the children of Israel when he's right after they worship the golden calf. So he's using cattle terminology and not flattering cattle terminology like tasty, you know, either. Of course, we don't really want God to describe us as tasty, so I don't even know why I went there. All right. Anyway, now Psalm 115 is the poetic treatise on how people reflect the image of whatever or whoever it is that they ally themselves with and worship. Because that's really, when you're worshiping someone, you're completely allying yourself with them. It's not just like a human alliance. It's, you know, they are, when you ally yourself with a god or a thing above our God. So let's start in verse 1. Not to us, Adonai, not to us. And this is from the Tree of Life version, which I really like. When I study, I like the ESV, English Standard Version, because that's the version that I have, like, the interlinear in. It's my logos go-to. But for reading, I like the Tree of Life version. Not to us, Adonai, not to us, but to your name be the glory. Because of your love and your faithfulness, why should the nations say, where is their God now? Our God is in the heavens. He does whatever pleases him. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but they cannot speak, eyes, but cannot see, They have ears but cannot hear, noses but cannot smell. They have hands but cannot feel, feet but cannot walk, nor utter a sound with their throat. Those making them will become like them, everyone trusting in them. Okay, I want you to hear that again. Those making them, namely the idols, will become like them, everyone trusting in them. So not only the people who make the idols, but the people who trust in the idols will become like them. Now, what did it say? Let's go back. They have mouths, but they cannot speak. Again, everyone making and trusting in them will become like them. Eyes, but cannot see. Everyone making and trusting in them will become like them. Ears, but cannot hear. Noses, but cannot smell. Hands, but cannot feel. Feet, but cannot walk. Nor can they utter a sound with their throat. Psalm 115, we also see this through the prophets, but this is just the place where it's most obvious. The people who worship and make idols will become like them. That is why Adam and Eve became deceptive in the garden after allying themselves with a serpent. That is why the children of Israel became unruly, stiff-necked, and eager to throw off the yoke once they worshipped the golden calf. Something spiritual happens to us when we do not have our proper focus. And I mean, that's not too... It's almost like, and I wrote this into Context for Kids 4, what's it called? I've got it over. Image Bearing, Idolatry, and the New Creation. It's my family curriculum, Volume 4. And I described it as a computer virus. When these people did these things, something happened to them. And the Bible records it because the language God uses to describe them becomes the language you would use to describe serpents or unruly cattle. In idols, blind, deaf, lame, you know, unable to walk, you know. And of course, halakha, walk, is the word that describes how we walk in the commandments. And I go into this, you know, in that book. So this is a quickie overview, not because it's only an hour. So the prophets use this same language to describe Israel, the northern kingdom, and Judah, the southern kingdom, as they went increasingly astray after idols, even bringing them into the temple itself under some kings, most notably Ezekiel, when Ezekiel was shown the presence of God actually leaving the temple, and it never returned. Never returned to Israel until it came in the person of Yeshua. Anyway, so blind, deaf, and powerless because they worshipped gods that had no eyes, no ears, and no power. In the times of Judges and from Solomon to the exile, so many idols. And when they worshipped them, they fell before their enemies. They were becoming what we can call, here's some modern idioms for image bearers. They were becoming chips off the old block and apples that didn't fall very far from the tree. Because they were worshiping stone, metal, and wood idols that were powerless, so they became like them. And we may not understand it, but we can see in Scripture that it's true. It hardly seems possible. You know, we're a scientific people. It's like, how on earth could you do something so simple, so horrible? Okay, you know, it is horrible. And have it infect you so much that you become like whatever it is that has captured your imagination, that you've gone to worship. And it seems crazy. It's so anti-scientific. But you know, we are not just living in a world where we can see everything and we can quantify everything. There's a real spiritual battle going on behind the scenes. And frankly, a lot of stuff that we just don't understand. And that's okay that we don't understand. You know, so many times I talk to people and they say, well, that just doesn't make any sense to me. So, does everything have to make sense to us? You know how small our minds and awareness are compared to God, and we're trying to quantify, you know, we're trying to understand this stuff. It just doesn't work. Anyway, we will be back in a few minutes with the second part of this teaching. We're going to talk about some practical applications and how this, we become what we worship, looks like in our real lives today. Hi, welcome back to Character in Context, and again, I'm Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and we've been talking about what it means to be an image bearer and what that looks like in real life. For better or for worse, are we bearing God's image, or are we bearing the image of the world? And in our case, honestly, it's a combination, because none of us are perfect image bearers. I wish it wasn't the truth, but it is the truth. We all have areas where we do not reflect our Creator. And in some areas, not at all. That's why, you know, we need to, that's why it's called fruit, because fruit needs to grow. And before fruit can grow, the tree needs to mature. And yeah, that takes a while. We want it to be, bam, overnight. Doesn't work that way. But through Yeshua, the perfect image bearer, by listening to him, by aligning ourselves with him, by becoming loyal to God through him, by saying, yes, I look at Yeshua, you may know him as Jesus, and I see that he perfectly reflects your character. That is who you are. It if you know, and it's a way to counteract the other things that we historically have allied ourselves with, like in the garden, the serpent, and Adam and Eve immediately became deceptive. At Mount Sinai, the golden calf, and all of a sudden, God starts using language describing unruly cattle, you know, stiff-necked, throwing off the yoke, that kind of stuff. So, and we see it in the prophets, in the Psalms, worshiping idols, like it says in Psalm 115, makes you blind and deaf, and makes it so you can't walk in the commandments, that sort of thing. So, but how does this look like in our lives? Because I talked about how it looked when you are emulating a god. Like, I talked specifically about the Babylonians with Ishtar and with Oannes, and how both of their cults were entirely different and believed different things. And, well, I'm not going to say they believed different things. They focused on different things, because the two gods, Ishtar was very erratic. She was the god of prostitution, war, and she was the queen of the Babylonian pantheon. And then you have Oannes, who is the god who brought wisdom. And so he was much more reasonable. If you're going to emulate somebody and it's a heathen god, better Oannes than Ishtar, who was married to a bunch of guys and animals and treacherously betrayed every single one. not nice. Anyway, so, but in modern times, because we no longer believe in multiple gods, we are not, in the world today, there's very, well, I'm not going to say there's very little polytheism going on, because frankly, you've got the Hindus, and you've got a lot of the Chinese religions that have a multitude of gods and goddesses, or a plethora. Yes, I know what plethora means. It would be very deeply upsetting to think that I had a plethora of pinatas, if in fact I did not have a plethora of pinatas. So, and if you got that, you're old and you have a cheesy sense of humor. But we in the West, we live in a monotheistic society, and so we just, it's hard for us to understand what it was like to believe naturally in a whole lot of gods, and to believe that this culture has, that our culture has gods that only have authority in our region, they're regional gods, and they take care of the cosmic functions here. And that other country, yeah, they have their own gods too, and they take care of stuff over there. And hopefully our gods are more powerful than theirs and can kick their butts and we'll get their land. Okay? But we are different these days. We are more scientific than spiritual. We don't see the world as divided up between different pantheons, and we look at things differently. But that doesn't mean we can't worship things. That doesn't mean we can't focus and obsess about things and ally ourselves with things and become like them. Become made, remade in their image instead of the image of God, which is what our belief in Yeshua was supposed to do. It was supposed to realign us to God, because obviously we see that the Torah was not enough to do that, because right there at Sinai, after they received it, oh my gosh, like 5 minutes, not 5 minutes later, but sometime within the next 40 days later, they made a golden calf and they were immediately worshiping, immediately becoming stiff-necked and rebellious and throwing off the yoke. And it's scary how quickly we can do these things. But to them, the rules were external and arbitrary, and it wasn't in their heart. Jeremiah 31 says the new covenant would be on our hearts. And if anyone has ever participated in the new creation experience after salvation, you know what I'm talking about. You change. You don't just change on the outside, conforming to expectations. On the inside, you really do begin to change, and change in ways that we never wanted to change. There are things I gave up I didn't want to give up. Wasn't even my idea to give up. And it's like all of a sudden one day, it's like, you're going to give that up, or I just suddenly didn't want to do them. My favorite story is 2 weeks after I got saved back in January 1999, one of my coworkers says, "Hey, when did you stop swearing?" And I was like, "I stopped swearing? I mean, I didn't do it on purpose, but God didn't like it. He got rid of it, and I really didn't, you know." There we go. It wasn't something that I chose. I didn't see anything wrong with swearing. Honestly, I didn't. But God overruled me, and then it was gone. So, and I mean, I was like a sailor, you gotta know. So, back, I just see squirrels and I guess go running. Have you ever known anyone who was obsessed with gaining wealth? How do they act and look? Do they act and look like paupers, or do they often live beyond, you know, dress even beyond their means, trying to portray a certain image? And do they feel that they need to look ostentatious, or do they look unassuming and austere? There are some really, really wealthy people who do live very austere lives, but there are few and far between. Now, how about people who worship their own bodies at the gym? Are they, you know, dressing modestly and, you know, not wearing tight-fitting clothing? Or do they want everyone to see, you know, how good they look? You know, so they being modest, are they just happy to be healthy, or do they want everyone to see what they look like? Well, you know, when I was working out, what the answer to that was. Who were the Pharisees worshiping, or what were the Pharisees worshiping when some of them, not all of them, because this was actually outlawed in the Talmud, made their tefillin, their extra large, and their tassels extra long? They were worshiping status, their own honor. They wanted that honor. Now, that being said, I'm not picking on the Pharisees, because I've seen some insanely long tassels on some Messianic Jews and Hebrew Roots people as well, before, you know, we go and give ourselves a pass. How about people who worship their own correctness and will not be proven wrong? My friend Ryan White wrote this excellent article called The Certainty Idol, where he delves into that problem, which hits people of all faiths, denominations, it hits scientists, it hits, you know, hits a lot of people, and to some extent, all of us, you know? You can find that article on his website, faithofmessiah.com. So when our focus is off, our worship is off. Where our focus is, our heart is. And we will behave accordingly, becoming like, through constant exposure and attention, that which we cherish. As G.K. Beale says, we become what we worship. And that is an excellent book of his, by the way. When I wrote my Image-Bearing Idolatry in the New Creation, that was one of the books, it was one of the three books I based it off of, that and one by N.T. Wright and one by Richard Lentz. But this is why we need Yeshua, so that we can focus on the image of the unseen God, so that we can properly become faithful images ourselves. You know, it's not enough to be a mirror, because not all mirrors give a faithful representation. When I wrote Image-Bearing Idolatry in the New Creation, because this is a family curriculum, because I'm describing it to all age groups, I explained it this way, and I love this. God just put this in my mind one day, because I'm not that smart. Imagine going into a fun house, Okay, and you're looking at your reflection in the mirror. Are you going to see what you actually look like? Well, no, of course not. You are going to see a distorted, ridiculous image. And if somebody saw that image and then someone said, okay, now pick this person out of a crowd, you're going to be going, that person isn't here. Okay? The same thing if you get a cracked mirror. If the mirror is cracked in the right place, you're not going to get a good image. If the mirror is tilted off center and you're not looking full into it, also, you're not going to get an accurate image of the person who's supposed to be reflected. And that's what we become. Bad reflections of God when we aren't looking full into God's mirror of Yeshua. And it's hard to look at him, I'm telling you, and we think we're looking full on, and oftentimes we're not. But when our character doesn't match up with him, when we are breaking bruised reeds, when, this occurred to me last night, I just never thought about this before. You know, Yeshua told his disciples, you sell your cloak and buy a sword. But then as soon as one of them used the sword, they got rebuked. See, sometimes Yeshua tells us to purchase something, but it doesn't mean we get to use it. And there's a lot of things like that. A lot of times we make assumptions. Peter decided that since Yeshua said, buy a sword, well, this must be when he wants me to use it. Wasn't Peter always doing that kind of stuff? And aren't we just a little too much like Peter in too many areas of our life where we make assumptions about how Yeshua wants us to act instead of just emulating him where we can, realizing, of course, that we in a lot of ways are lacking because we are not sinless. We do not have perfect discernment. We cannot tell what's in a person's heart. And so sometimes we make assumptions we shouldn't, and we judge a person and condemn a person when it is inappropriate to do so. So we judge in error. And there's no way to get around that. We're going to. Because there are two ways to judge. You know, well, there are actually a multitude of ways to judge. But you can judge someone innocent when they're guilty, or guilty when they're innocent. Or you can judge them guilty when they're guilty and innocent when they're innocent. And we don't have that perfect discernment. So a lot of times we make the wrong call. That's why we have to be humble. Yeshua was humble. We have to be even more humble than Yeshua, because we are not all that in a bag of chips. But back before I was saved, I was a porn addict. This is something I talk about a lot. I was a porn addict from the ages of 8 to 32. And when I was a porn addict, I reflected that in my life. Not that I was, you know, going out and being in movies and everything, but I was writing pornography for the internet. I was obsessed with it. It was part of my life. It was part of my, I was thinking about it constantly. Fortunately, when I got saved, I gave that up, and God delivered me a few years later of the terrible tormenting thoughts. But for a long time, that was the center of my life. When I was an MMO addict, and MMOs are massive multiplayer online games, MMO. It's these big games. I played a Warhammer Online and World of Warcraft, and my life reflected the fact that I was an addict to those games. You know, I would think about it all the time. For a while there, for about a year, I wouldn't even think about God. I just think about getting on my game. I didn't want to think about my kids and my husband. I was just obsessed. And I thought it filled certain needs in my life that I had for feeling important and companionship and being able to achieve something that's recognizable. And I'm not going to go into why I felt I needed that, but it stained my life and it became what I worshipped. Any sort of addict is going to reflect image their obsession. They're going to become image bearers for that obsession, whether that addiction is sex, drugs, entertainment, pornography, money, food is a big one. I'm speaking from experience here. There's virtually no limit to what we humans can become imagers of. And an imager is someone who is an image bearer for something else. Okay, an imager. You know, and we violently protect our obsessions and addictions. You know, I saw a believer just last week violently defend their watching of a very explicit television show. This was a Torah observant person. With some way over the top judgments of anyone who didn't approve. Now, I was the same way with video games back when I was an addict. You know, although some people can dabble in video games, I am so bad. I'm telling you right now, I am so bad that I can't even play Farmville. Everything has to be eliminated off my phone and my computers. I swore an oath to Adonai, to God, that I would never play an online game again. And I haven't, but sometimes I have dreams about playing them. And then I wake up, it's like, ah, you know, come on. And sometimes in dreams, I can't resist. I don't resist. Then I wake up feeling bad. And it's a while before I realize that it's like, no, it wasn't real. You know, I don't even play solitaire anymore because I know how I get. I loved the games more than people. And really, when we're willing to abuse other people in order to defend our doing of a thing, we've really got to think about where we have elevated that thing in our lives. What is it more important than? How much weight have we given it? Do we worship these things? Because I can think of a lot of stands that I see where people just post and post and post and post about it on social media. And I'm going, I never see you post about anything other than that. That's scary to me because that's the image they're bearing. And I'm not saying they don't love God. I'm just saying that it's easy to get sidetracked. So anyway. Anything that we worship and focus overly on, besides God, will impart to us a character that is less than godly. And I'm not saying that we can't have hobbies or be entertained, because that would be silly, but when our lives center around those things, we begin to reflect it in ways that detract from being image bearers. And we see this in the concept in the ancient Near East of something called the royal messenger. And in the ancient world, a king, especially a suzerain king, would send his ambassadors out to other lands where he would have vassal kings. That ambassador was implicitly trusted. He had to be, in some ways, exactly like his liege. He had to have the same values. He had to have the same agendas. He had to faithfully relay every message, whether he agreed with it or not. This is what we see with the prophets and stuff. We see people who are required to give messages that aren't theirs, but they have to do it faithfully, but also had to do it bearing the character of that king, or obviously international relations could break down, wars could start, and the king could end up looking bad, looking weak, looking like, you know, unreasonable, looking crazy, whatever. So you got that concept. And Yeshua, of course, was the perfect royal messenger, because oftentimes I messed up. That other stuff I was talking about, a messenger. Royal messenger is when a member of the royal family is sent out to represent the king. And in this case with God, it was his son who perfectly reflected everything about him. Now, I want to talk about a really sad thing that happened the other day. Wasn't on my social media wall. Don't go looking and talk about it. This is something I watched go on where a friend of mine who's in ministry, actually an acquaintance, I don't know him personally. He runs a large ministry, and he posted something, and it was a surprise to somebody else who I know. And so she tagged in some people and said, wow, what do you think about this? And when she tagged people in, it was her belief that she was tagging in people who shared her values, who would behave themselves like she would behave herself on the post. When she tagged people in, she was becoming responsible for their behavior, which she thought would be awesome, or she wouldn't have done this. I'm telling you right now, she would not have done this. A guy comes in and says, well, to hell with this doctrine and to hell with anyone who supports it. And I saw it, and I because someone tagged me in on it, and I was very upset. And I said, I would never curse a brother or sister to hell over anything. This is absolutely, it's one thing to disagree with people. We need to be able to disagree. Disagreement's great. That's how we learn. That's how we talk. But when you're going to curse to hell somebody who disagrees with you, somebody for whom our Messiah died, whom he is working the new creation life in, somebody who may be doing a lot more than I am, probably is, just because of a doctrinal difference. That's crazy. And, oh, this poor woman who brought this guy in, because the guy just starts. And the thread owner came on. I told him what was going on, and I knew he'd care. And he came on and said, whoa, you don't curse any of my brothers and sisters in the faith. You just don't do it. You don't make, you know, and it just got ugly. And this poor woman who had tagged him in, she was just bereft. She was so humiliated, embarrassed. Why? Because she tagged him in, because it looked like she was responsible, like she must approve, like this was what she wanted, when it was the farthest thing from what she wanted, this poor dear saint. I felt sick for her. Everyone felt sick for her. And no matter how much we just gave a little hearts on her comments and said, this isn't your fault, sis. This was not your intention. Da, 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 da. But still, she felt responsible, and she was crying, and she was just, it wasn't what she wanted. And so I think about this when oftentimes people get hurt by those who proclaim themselves to be God's messengers. There are some abusive, quote-unquote, messengers of God out there. And who gets the blame? The person who decided to behave badly, or God? Well, it's always God. Well, not always. But with new people and with people who are wounded and hurting, the image that is born is assumed to be that of God. And so as cruel and nasty and abusive as they were, people associate that with God. Well, if you're God's minister, then this must be the God, this must be an accurate reflection of the God you serve. Okay? And that's why we have to be so careful, because we do not want to do that to God. It is an incredible burden. It is an incredible responsibility, and not a right to reflect God. We can't just do it any way we want. And in the places where we know that we are not as forgiving as he is, we need to be careful. In places where we do not have the discernment, we have to be careful, which is every place. Honestly, we lack in every way. And so that is why for whatever we want to do, we have to be very prayerful and careful before we go out and do it. And before we say, thus saith the Lord, when the Lord has not said, when really it's our own offense rising up, it's our own ego getting in the way, we have cruelty about us. We can be very cruel. And when we do not, when we are cruel in the name of God, we're telling people that God is cruel. And I've heard people say, well, you know, the word of God shall not go up void, it shall accomplish the purpose to which I sent it. But see, they don't say the last part. They just say the word shall not go out void. But when we change it, it's no longer for the purpose that he sent it out for. If you are clubbing somebody over the head while reciting John 3:16, for God so loved the world. Yeah. That's not the word of God anymore. We've made it void. By not sending it out his way, with his character, with his actions, with his intentions, we're not bearing his image. We're bearing the image of the world. We're bearing the image of the evil one, whatever. And really, there's no greater crime we can commit on this earth than to badly represent God's character. Better to do anything else than to cause people to stumble over us, thinking that we are faithful representatives of God. So anyway, I hope that this helps you. I hope that this makes it clear to you what an image bearer is and what our incredible responsibility is and how we can damage God and other people by doing it wrong, as well as damage other people when they take us in on something and we behave badly. Take care.